This is Equestrian Legacy Radio.
He was the new kid on the circuit, gold buckles in his eyes. But the horse he drew was plenty rank, and much to his surprise, he did a double backflip, landed on his head. This old cowboy limped out in the ring, leaned over him and said, "You better cowboy up when you get thrown down. Get right back in the saddle as soon as you hit the ground. You've heard that the tough get going when the going gets tough. But around here all we say is, son, you better cowboy up." By the end of last season, said he was among the best, so he proudly called the girl back home, hoping she would be impressed. But her mama said she married the guy he used to call his friend, and before the first tear could fall, these words came back again: "You better cowboy up when you get thrown down. Get right back in the saddle
to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and I'm your host, Gary Holt. We have a great show for you today. Our guests include Joni Harms, multi-award-winning singer-songwriter, David Williams, a leading breeding farm manager in the country, and we also are joined by Dr. Krista Gillum, one of the premier equine vets in the state of Tennessee. When we come back, we'll be talking with Joni Harms.
Grabbed my old blanket, ran out right away. Dad's in
cinched up the saddle and handed me the reins. And even though I was so scared, my blanket was right there, made 100 years ago by the hands of the Navajo, sold by some old trader on the side of a dusty road. It still holds the hair of many a pretty pony, the only real treasure that I own is this old saddle blanket. Well, I've known many horses, rode many a rodeo, took my saddle blanket everywhere I'd go. Its colors may have faded, but it's still as good as new. You can bet I'd never trade it after all that we've been through. And sometimes I still get scared, but my blanket's always there, made 100 years ago by the hands of the Navajo, sold by some old trader on the side of a dusty road. It still holds the hair of many a pretty pony,
That's Joni Harms and Saddle Blanket, and we're so happy to have Joni joining us today. Joni is the Female Western Swing Artist of the Year with the Academy of Western Artists, a multi-talented singer-songwriter. And Joni, welcome to the show today.
Gary, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a joy to have you joining us, and I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with you, but we have a lot of listeners that we want to introduce you to today. And I'd like to start out, Joni, by talking a little bit about your early days, because I know you're a real cowgirl. So tell us about your life growing up.
Well, I grew up on a century farm that was homesteaded by my great-great-grandfather Harms in 1872. And it's raised just about everything out here at one time or the other, but pretty much a cattle ranch. We just having some new babies on the ground now. One of my favorite times of year to watch those little calves running around. So it's really all I've ever known, and I'm very proud of that fact that you know, have such roots out here. Not a lot of people can say that anymore, that you know they have history of living in the same place all their life. In fact, my dad never lived anywhere else, or my grandfather. Except for the short time that he served in World War II. So, you know, it's something special.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And you're located, is it in Canby, Oregon?
Correct. Yeah, it's about 40 miles or so south of Portland. And, you know, very, very musical family. Everybody in my family always played some instrument or another. My father was probably best known for his concertina on the accordion. He played a lot on that, and we used to love to listen to him do that. I have a brother, Buck, who plays guitar and just about anything he picks up too. Very talented musician. And then my sister, Chris, she plays the piano mostly. And then there was me. I'm 10 years younger than Buck and Chris, so I kind of came along and latched on to all the wonderful music as well, and really was the only one, though, that pursued it for a career, and have been so happy that I chose to go that direction.
Well, I bet the family gatherings at the Harms house was a lot of fun.
Yes, a lot of good cooking and a lot of good music. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, coming from a musical family, at what point in your life, Joni, was it that you decided that was the direction you wanted to go? Was there something before that? Did you have another career, or how did you get started in music?
I knew at a very early age. In fact, I started singing Cowgirl Sweetheart and such at rodeos. Rodeo's always been a big part of my life, too. At 3-4 years old, so I could practically sing a song about the same time I could talk. So, you know, I was just around it so much, and I think music is just something that has to come out of you if you're born with that kind of a feeling of talent of music. You know, you just have to get it out. And so I pursued that. I always knew I wanted to be a rodeo queen and a country music singer. And thank goodness I've been able to accomplish both. I did probably five, six years of different rodeo queen titles and would sing everywhere I went doing that, you know, either the national anthem or a lot of times that maybe the rodeo dance afterwards as I got a little older and had my band. And those folks just embraced me like you wouldn't believe. In fact, I still to this day play at a lot of the same fairs and rodeos I started playing for way back then.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, let's go back to talk about the Century Farm just a minute and growing up that way.
Sure.
How many generations actually lived on the farm at the same time?
Well, I'm the fifth generation.
Okay.
And so, you know, like when there was a time when I was fairly young, my grandfather still lived in on this place in a separate little house, and then my mom and dad in another. And it's been through a lot of different situations, a lot of changes. We now have a log home that we built in the very exact location the original house was put. But through the years, you know, it was never really structured as well as it should have been to be something that went on and on. So you know, the foundation got bad enough that it was just time to rebuild. And so we hopefully have a place now that'll be here at least another 100 years or more.
Well, that's great. Do you remember any particular family musical events where maybe your granddad and your dad and the rest of the family were all together?
Well, I know my brother and sister do, but me being, you know, 10 years later, there's just a few times that I remember that. I do vaguely, but certainly he, you know, my grandfather was a songwriter too. He even had some sort of a little sheet music that we still have here that I think it was called Meat in the Pot or something, you know, that he had written and published. And so, you know, the history of songwriting and music, just go back in the Harms family a long ways.
Oh, that's great. Well, there's a song that you wrote called Harm's Way. Is there a story behind that?
Well, absolutely. That was a song I wrote with Hobo Jim, one of my very favorite co-writers. And you know, we just talked about the fact that there is such history here, and both my mom and dad have passed on now. And, you know, I just feel so blessed to still have this ranch and to pass it on, hopefully, to my son Luke or my daughter Olivia. And it's just, you know, when we did the album, we put a lot of photos of the old, you know, 100 years ago, what the place looked like then and up to what it looks like now. And I have had more emails and comments from people about how much they've really enjoyed seeing history like that because, you know, sometimes over in different parts of the world, there, you know, a ranch is just not is something maybe that everybody, wherever they live, New York City, wherever, has dreamed about maybe playing the role of a cowboy at one time or the other. And so just being able to sing the song and then have the visual pictures available to folks to see that has just really been rewarding for me.
Well, let's listen to Harm's Way. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the rodeo queen and her career in music. And you're talking, we're talking with Joni Harms, and you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Grandpa Harms built this homestead with hard-working hands. He knew he'd found a piece of heaven when he first looked on this land. He knew that it wouldn't be easy, but the harder it got, the more he he'd gladly do the work of ten if need be, when another man would surely walk away. Never in harm's way. He and Grandma raised a family the same way they raised their crops, with tenderness and patience and love that never stops. It was mighty hard work around the harvest, picking apples, cutting wood and hauling hay, gathering up the goods out of the garden, 'cause absolutely nothing went to waste. Sometimes it still isn't easy, but the tougher it gets, the more I pray. Sometimes it feels like he's here walking with me, and when I'm just about to quit, I hear him say, never in harm's way. No.
That's Harm's Way by Joni Harms, and Joni, that brings up some really powerful images. Beautiful song.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful if a song can paint a picture, isn't it?
Well, it really is, and that song certainly does.
Thank you. I hope so.
Was there? We're gonna play a song a little bit later in the show called "Let's Put the Western Back in Country." One of the things, as we've talked with our guests over the last several months, is there's quite a difference between the Western genre of music and some of the others. Was there a point in time that you made the decision to do Western music? Were you interested in something else? How did that come about?
Well, I got my first national record deal with Capitol Records, and the legendary Jimmy Bowen signed me to that label, who has, recorded everybody from George Strait to Reba McEntire to Frank Sinatra. I mean, so he's a great producer, and I was very honored that he signed me to Capitol Records. And, you know, I was exposed to country radio in the late 80s and 90s then with that first deal, and had a couple top 20 singles out on the charts, and, you know, was really loving it. However, it seemed that time of, you know, country music was really starting to lean more towards pop than the traditional country that I love. You know,
right.
And I mean, I love Western because I'm a rancher and I grew up where I did around rodeo and cowboys and horses and cattle. But I love good traditional country music. I mean, that's very much still a lot of what I do. But I think it well, a little bit later, I got the opportunity to sign with Warner Western, which is where Michael Martin Murphy and Sons of the San Joaquin, Red Steagall, those guys were on there, and I just, there was a magic that I felt when I got signed to that label where I just felt, you know what, this is really the good, this is the fit for me. This is where I belong. And so we did an album off at that label called Cowgirl Dreams. And then unfortunately, Jim Ed Norman dissolved that label shortly after my CD was released. But I still, after that, felt the direction that I had gone there was where I really needed to stay. And that there is, in fact, some folks out there that do love the traditional sounds of country and Western, whichever you want to call it, music, and they need to be fed, too. And there's a place for us who like to play and perform that kind of music. It may not be as big as maybe, the more pop country music or get as much exposure, but we need to keep it out there.
Well, it seems that the Western music and the cowboy music is really more of a form of telling a story today.
Well, a lot of times, certainly it is, and to me, that's. Yeah, I don't really care so much for a song if it doesn't have lyric content that touches my heart in some form or another. I mean, that's my favorite kind of a song to write. Is if I feel like, if I can touch somebody with what I can say. Just like my favorite song probably that I can think of right off the top of my head would be Dolly Parton's The Coat of Many Colors. It's not
right.
really a Western song, but it tells such a story that I remember listening to that over and over and over again, just trying to dissect what it was that she had done there that made me feel what I felt by listening to the song.
Right, right.
So, I think you're right. I think we try to, as I'd said on Harm's Way, try to paint a picture with what we say in our songs.
Well, and you certainly do, and that's one of the things that that I love about the Western and the cowboy music, and one of the things that we're hopefully introducing a larger audience to. But let's talk about your early days when you got started with your career, and you mentioned you had come to Nashville. At what point in time did that happen?
Well, I was just out of high school and, really had a lot of support. As I'd said, through the FFA program, Future Farmers of America, had won a talent contest, national talent contest with them. A lot of had taken my rodeo queening up to the point of being runner-up for Miss Rodeo America. And so I had quite a bit of exposure with what I was doing and ran into some folks that said, you know what, we need to get you to Nashville and do a little demo there. And so that's what we did. I recorded the demo with Byron Gallimore, who's a famous producer in Nashville now as well, Tim McGraw and various folks. And he and I kind of hit it off, and he kind of saw the direction of what I really wanted to be and nurtured that. And then it was that tape that I had done or CD that I had done, got to Jimmy Bowen, and that's kind of when things really, really took off. And I give credit to the time that I've been on major labels as to maybe why I am able to play as much in other countries as I am today, because of the exposure they gave me by getting my CDs released in Europe and Australia and New Zealand and all the different kind of places that I still am fortunate enough to go play my music now.
Well, and we want to talk more about your international travels in just a minute, but there's another song that you did that I think also paints a beautiful picture. And as you and I were talking a little bit earlier, it made me want to head out to Montana. And this is a song. Well, it may be too cold out there for me in Montana right now, but or maybe too much snow. But this is a beautiful song called Blue Montana Moon by Joni Harms. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we'll be back in a minute to talk more with Joni Harms. Montana Moon, and I tell you, Joni, I could actually see myself camping out under the stars there in Montana listening to that song. A beautiful song. But let's talk a little bit about your international travels, because, and I want to mention this too, we're hosting a national trail ride that's going to be held in 5 states across the country. And you're going to be in concert in Burlington, Washington, at the Butler Hill Equestrian Center on June the 7th as part of that event, and we're grateful for that. But when we were trying to get in touch with you, I was talking with our mutual friend Lance Cowan, and he said, well, she's in New Zealand, so we have to wait till she gets back. So talk to us a little bit about your international travels and what's that been like compared to performing here in the States, because I know you were in Jackson just about a week or so ago. What's the difference in the audiences there, and how is that for you?
Well, you know, as much as I love the ranch and being home, I guess there's a bit of gypsy in me or whatever you want to call it, because I do love to take my music and go different places around the world. And you know what, it's just amazing to find that there are folks who love this kind of music wherever you go. And New Zealand is almost like going back 15, 20 years in time, Gary. They are just rural, wonderful, down-home people. And you know, the connection with my music there has just been really special. I mean, just that's my second time to go over there now, and I did several festivals and just met some of the nicest people. They're the kind of folks that, you know, they'll come up to you after the show and say, well, why don't you come on back to house for supper with us or something like that. You know, they just, stuff that you don't run into just everywhere anymore. But I've you know, traveled a lot in Europe. In fact, last July, I recorded a live album over there with a family band called the Sheeran Family, and that's going to be released this May coming up. And so I'm going to go back over to Ireland and do kind of a kickoff party for that live album. It will be called From Oregon to Ireland, which is a little Irish ditty type song that I wrote for that CD. And Tony Lundervold, the guy who runs my website, is putting together the cover as we've been doing. He's a past bronc rider and a good country singer himself, and so he's doing a great job on that for us. And we're just getting the CD mastered in Nashville right now, and so I'm very, very excited to have another new album to share with folks, especially live from another country, you know?
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm going to put myself on the list to get that music when you release that. So, and we'll want to have you come back on the show and talk with us again about those things.
I'd love that, Gary.
So, and I think I saw something on YouTube where you were performing in France. How was that to perform for a French audience?
Well, you know, there's a lot of folks there that are really into their horses, and as you probably well know, and traditional country music. I've done a lot of different places in Europe, and France seems to be one of the places I get invited back to quite often. So I've got quite a bunch of friends over there now. And one of the places I've played is called Equiblues, which is a horse event out in the Alps of France. I've been up there maybe, I think, 3-4 times, different times of going up to play for that. And folks just come from all over to go participate in the equestrian events, as well as come hear some good traditional country music. So, I think that, as I said earlier in the interview, folks all over the world have imagined what it would be like to be a cowboy at one time or the other, or a cowgirl. And so I'm just happy to have the opportunity to go share that experience with different people.
Well, that's pretty exciting, and I know we have a lot of listeners that are in Europe to this program as well. We have folks that are in Sweden and in Germany and South Africa, and where will you be touring in the next few months?
Well, if it's okay, I'm going to go ahead and just give my website to Gary. It's www.joniharms.com. And we have as I was saying, Tony does a good job keeping the touring up to date on there. We have a bunch of new things that need to be added, which will include not only this trip in May to Ireland, but a whole other tour in Europe of different countries, which will be shown on there. So I hope that some of my friends over there in Europe will check that out and try to get out to our show, and really a lot in the States too. I'm looking forward to the date we're doing in Washington with you, Gary, and supporting a wonderful cause at the same time.
Well, we're looking forward to having you with us out there, so we look forward to that. We've been talking with Joni Harms. She is just a fantastic individual, and as you've been listening to her music, you know, a great entertainer and performer, a real cowgirl, and when you get out to Washington for this national trail ride that's going on, you'll have to bring your horse, Joni, or at least borrow one when you get out there.
I'd love to do that. Absolutely. I suppose it'll depend on what the weekend bookends around your event are. But no, I'll maybe come get inspired to write some new music out there too, I'm sure, with the folks that come out to that.
Well, I know they're looking forward to having you in Washington State to perform as well. So, Joni, thanks for spending time with us on the show today, and we certainly look forward to having you back. Thanks for giving of your time to help with the event in Washington State. And, you know, we didn't get to talk about this, but we'll talk about this the next time you're on the show if we can, and that's Western Swing. And we're going to close this segment of the program out with Let's Put the Western Back in Country. And, Joni, thanks again for joining us on the show today.
Gary, thank you so much for having me, and thank you to all the listeners out there as well.
All right, thank you so much. This is Let's Put the Western Back in Country by Joni Harms. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and when we come back, we'll be talking with David Williams and Dr. Krista Gillum. Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we want to welcome to the show now David Williams, who is the Vice President of the Breeders Division with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association, and also Dr. Krista Gillum, one of the most respected equine vets in the state of Tennessee. So David and Krista, how are you?
Good.
Doing great, Gary. I hope you can hear us well. We've got you on speakerphone. We're here in the office at Rising Star.
Well, I can hear you just fine right now, and so thanks for joining us on the show. And I teased some folks a little bit earlier about titling this show Music and Sex, but because we're because this show is for general audiences, we didn't title it that way, but we enjoyed the music with and visiting with Joni Harms, and we're going to talk a little bit now about something that's real exciting to folks, and that is babies being born, and breeding season is right here upon us. And so we can't have two better people to join us on the show to talk about that. Krista, I'd like to kind of start out visiting with you just a little bit, if it's okay. And as people are getting ready now to breed their mares, what are some things that they need to be doing in preparation? What type of vaccinations do they need to have? And how should they be preparing their mares to go to the breeding farm?
Well, you know, so much depends, Gary, on, if you've had this mare for some time, if you know their breeding, their history. I always say the most important thing about a mare is their history of foaling. But about a month before they foal, I suggest, and when I say that, I go back. They have breeding charts most people use, and I go about a month back. And that's when I give the vaccinations, because it's the only time you can vaccinate two for one. I say you get a really good deal. So if you vaccinate a mare with Eastern, Western, Tetanus, Rhino Flu, West Nile rabies, if you use those, as you use little vaccinations, it's the only time that baby's going to get it through the colostrum if things go well. And that baby will stay immunized for like 5, 6, 7 months. So it's a really good deal for everybody. So I always say a month back, you check your mare out and make sure she's got her yearly shots, and make sure she doesn't have a Caslix. In other words, she's not sutured. Those are the two things I do about a month before foaling.
Okay. Well, we've come out of a pretty tough winter in a lot of parts of the country. It's been just a really, really cold winter here in the Southeast, and other parts of the country have had just extremely cold, tough weather. What kind of shape should the mare be in, and what should you be doing to get her ready as far as condition to be breeding?
Well, you know, that's absolutely been a problem this year. The mares, the hay quality, I don't think maybe has been quite as good as usual, or the availability. But, you know, especially in Middle Tennessee, fescue is a worry. Because there's a fungus that can grow on the fescue that absolutely interferes with, the correct date of foaling, the milk production. So people really need to pay attention to diet. It's a whole lot cheaper that way, and so much better for the mare and baby. But, I always say if you know you've got pretty much been feeding fescue, you really need to get them off about 60 days before they foal, and get them on a higher plane of nutrition. And when I say that, that, again, is so dependent on the mare. You know, we have some mares that are, a little bit, overweight. And you can't grain them as much as you can grain a mare that's not. But on the other hand, there's vitamins that you can give. There's different types of feed that you can feed that will go through to the baby and cause, a good nutritional gain.
Okay. All right. Well, I know that years ago, before I was aware of the fescue problem, we lost some colts.
Absolutely.
Due to difficulty in foaling or mares just not having any milk at all. And, of course, we're going into breeding season. A lot of babies have already been born, but there are still a lot of babies to come in the next couple of months. David, you've had a tremendous amount of experience in raising these babies and breeding these mares. And you told me you told me a pretty funny story the other day about a fellow that had a mare that he brought to the farm to breed. But in your experience, what are some things that people need to be doing before they come to the farm? And what do you require as a breeder before the mare can come on to the property?
you know, requirements that we have when mayors travel in here, because like I said, we get mayors from all across the country, Gary, and, you know, most people are good about having the Coggins test pulled and, you know, health records and things like that, because those are, you know, basic requirements from state to state, you know, just so we're not transporting horses with any diseases or anything like that.
Right.
My advice to most people is it's always best to get a culture on your mare. You know, even though most people will say, well, my mare's clean, she's not a problem. I mean, it's always a hidden thing, and it always saves you time when you come to the breeding farm if you can come in with a clean uterine culture on your mare.
Right.
That'll let us know that we don't have a hidden problem that we have to deal with after the first cycle, because, you know, a lot of times you breed that first cycle, that mare doesn't catch. I mean, there's a reason she hadn't caught, you know, and it's either, you know, you had the semen quality was not good that day, the mare has an infection that's a problem, or the mare's got a, you know, a low progesterone level, which you can, you know, fix usually all three of those things. But the main thing that I ask people to do before they bring a mare here is to have her cultured. Bring us a clean negative culture. If it's not clean, whether they want to treat it at home or we know we need to treat it when they first get here, that's something we can do. And that what that does is save the owner time and money, because the mare won't be here that long trying to get in full.
Right, right. You share this story with us, because this was just really funny when you told me about
sure.
this. But you had a guy that came to the farm and was unhappy because his mare wasn't in foal. And
yeah, let me tell you about this guy.
Yeah, share that story.
It's a man from, you know, up north. You know, he was from above the Mason-Dixon line. I'll leave it at that. And he called me. We had his mare, and we bred her, and we checked her in foal before we left the year before. And everything was fine. Well, I want to say around December, he calls me, and he was quite upset and said, you know, my vet says my mare's not in foal. You know, I've spent this money to get this mare in foal. I'm not going to have a baby this year. And, you know, I told him, I said, yes, sir. I said, you know, that's a story I've heard before. I said, we want to make sure that you you get the value out of your stud fee and your mare, and you'll send her back, and we're going to breed her back for you. So it was about a couple of months later. He calls me and he says he's coming down. He says I'm bringing my mare. I'm bringing another mare. We're gonna get them bred. You know, I don't want to take long. He gave me another tongue lashing like he did the first time, and I just sat there and I took it and said, yes, sir, I understand. Said we're gonna do what we can to get this mare in foal. Well, he unloads the mare, the first mare I have not seen before, and we put her in a stall. But the mare in question, he unloads her. And she's covered head to toe with dried up mud on her, and kind of had a little pot belly to her. And I asked the gentleman, I said, how'd she get all this mud on her? He goes, well, you know, she wasn't pregnant. We just had her in this old muddy lot. I mean, she'd been out there with the gelding. You know, we just had her out there for the past couple months when the vet told me that she wasn't in foal. I go, okay. I said, did you happen to ever run her with a stud? When he determined that she wasn't in foal, he goes, well, you know, when we took her home after y'all checked her in foal, we let her run out with a stud up there that we had. I said, you know, her little pot belly there kind of, you know, throws me a little bit. I said, you know, if she's ran with that stud, I said, that stud could have got her in foal, you know, in the meantime. And he said, well, I don't think he did, because he had messed with her. And I said, that's fine. I said, why don't we do this? I said, you've got to drive, you know, all the way back home. I said, it's about a six-hour drive. I said, my vet will be here in about an hour. I said, let's check this mare and make sure that she's not in foal, because she is in foal. She's probably far, too far along to abort the baby, and we wouldn't want to do that, and you just put her back on the trailer and go home. Well, he was a little disgruntled about it, but he said, no, I'll wait. I said, okay. So he waited, and I went back to my office, and about 30 minutes later, he comes running to my office. He goes, David, he says, you were right. I said, so my vet, he's got here and he's checked her. He goes, no, I put her in that dry stall and she's laid down. She's had the baby. I said, I said, you got to be kidding me. He goes, no. Went right up there because it was her due date anyway from the time that we bred her. So that mare had been in that muddy lot for 2 months, and the first dry spot she found, she laid down and had the baby. Well, he was very apologetic then, and he comes up to me and he goes, David says, I'm sorry. He says, what do I do with her now? I said, well, I said, the first thing you might want to do is get another vet to check her when she's at home. Nothing against vets, because people can miss pregnancies all the time. I got a vet here in front of me, so I have to defend the vet.
Oh,
but,
gosh.
I said, let's not put them right back on the trailer. Let that baby stand and nurse, and let's get over this a little bit. And I know you want to get home. We're going to put her back on the trailer and send her home. But, you know, that's one of the most extreme cases we have. Now, we've had cases where people have check mares that, you know, they feel like aren't in foal. They'll come in here, and Krista can attest to it. We'll check them. They'll be, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 months in foal.
Right.
But that was the most extreme case, and, you know, just the way it all played out, it tickled us.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, I guess one of the first things that people make sure of then before they come to the farm is that the mare is not in foal. So
that is correct. Make sure she's not in foal. Like I said, we've had them deliver the mare and go ahead and leave, and I call them about an hour later up the road. I said, y'all might want to come back. They go, why? I go, well, we've already got her in foal. She's been in foal 4 months, so come on back and get her.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's an expensive proposition. Yeah, go ahead, Krista.
No, I get a few of those every year.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I explain, a lot of veterinarians, you know, they're in an area where, you know, I would say, there's people that play golf, but then there's professional golfers that get to play every day. And unfortunately, some veterinarians just don't get to check them very often. We take that into consideration.
You know, you wouldn't believe, Gary, the lack of what I call training that, you know, our large animal vets have hands-on with horses now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at school, I mean, really, as Krista could attest to, it's kind of on-the-job training. You know, most vets that aren't in a high-concentrated horse area like we are, you know, don't get the hands-on training like these vets do.
Right.
that are located around here. You know, I even had a vet, you know, from one of those areas that, you know, down past Memphis. He called us one day and he said, you know, I'm going to Australia to start a you know, an AI reproductive program, a horse program over in Australia. He says, David, he says, I hear y'all do a lot in a day. And he said, I'd love to come up there and, you know, just kind of get a refresher, get some more hands-on experience. I said, come on. And he came up there about a week later, and it was in the middle of fall breeding, which, you know, we were doing pretty good click at the time. And he came to me at the end of the day. He says, David, he says, I've done more repro work today than I've done in the past 6 months.
Wow.
I said, yeah. I said, we're a good refresher course. I said, you know, one thing about the volume that we do, Gary, you know, the train wrecks and the problems out there, we see them pretty regularly.
Right.
You know, it's... Most things are simple answers. You know, we run across things that are difficult to deal with, and, you know, we'll run across mares that, you know, more than likely have already had their last baby. They're not going to get in foal anymore.
Right,
but,
right.
That's just the nature of what we do. We get to see a lot of it, and, you know, we try to take advantage of the experience we have.
Well, and David, let's talk just a little bit about where you are, and of course, some of our listeners will know you, and many of our listeners will not. But how long have you been involved in the horse business and in breeding?
Well, the horse business, I've probably been involved with walking horses since I was about third grade. My father was a physician. And he had a friend of his that was a surgeon, and got my father involved with Tennessee Walking Horses, and I think my father began losing money that first day when he got that horse. But it's a kind of a lifelong love affair with the Tennessee Walking Horse. I've dealt with a lot of horses, quarter horses, thoroughbreds, you know, but the Tennessee Walking Horse has just kind of been in our blood since I was little. Doing what I do now, I kind of, you know, went to my background. I went to school. Chemistry is my background. I came out of school, and my brother started wanting to sell some yearlings, so we started dealing with some yearlings. That kind of grew, and I ended up running Dr. Sisk over in Columbia, his broodmare farm, and that grew. And I went over to Hall Walker's place and ran his stud farm, and you know, been at different stud farms since then. So you know, actually breeding horses, I've probably been doing that for at least 20, 25 years.
Okay. And again, because we have listeners that may not be familiar with you, you are located now at Rising Star Ranch in Shelbyville, Tennessee. And how many stallions do you stand there?
Last count this morning, it was 23. that number fluctuates daily around here. We also collect those are resident stallions, and we collect horses for people that, you know, haul in that want to take advantage of our breeding service. I mean, we've just recently dealt with Gypsy Vanner breeds, world champion paint horses, world champion quarter horses, just about any type of equine somebody wants to breed. I mean, we can sure facilitate.
Okay. All right, and that's a testament to your abilities when you have these other breeds that are coming in and utilizing your services. So I'll compliment you on that. But let's talk just a little bit. We talked about getting our mare ready to come to the breeding farm. What about stallion selection? What is the process? I mean, I would think that the first part of that would be to have the breeder with a goal in mind for the colt that he wants to raise.
That is always the first question I ask a breeder, Gary. You know,
uh-huh.
A lot of people just love raising horses. You know, they love the foal raising part, and, you know, they want to sell it when it's a yearling. So, you know, I ask them, I said, is your goal, you know, to keep this as your companion horse, a horse that you're going to pleasure ride, a horse that you want to, you know, hopefully take to the show ring, or are you just raising to sell, you know, a marketable horse? You know, they usually determine, I mean, kind of my conversations with them will determine kind of what direction they want to go. Then my next step is, you know, they inform me of their mare, you know, all the attributes of their mare, you know, their bloodlines. I'm big on bloodlines now. You know, so most of the time, you know, I learned this from my research of the thoroughbreds. You can have an individual there that probably doesn't look exactly like his bloodlines, you know, depict him to be, but, you know, more often than not, they will breed like their bloodlines, you know, breed. You know, they will produce the attributes that historically and, you know, the majority of the percentage that the bloodline produces. So, you know, we take that into account. You know, when dealing with show horses, we kind of take into account what crosses have done well with certain crosses. Bloodline crosses that produce, you know, the highest percentage of return on somebody taking a horse in the ring, whether it be flat shot or a performance horse. But, you know, mainly we don't breed any different for one or the other. I mean, basically we try to breed a balanced horse.
Okay.
You know, if I see a flaw or a fault in a stallion that a mare can, you know, compensate for, you know, we try to line those up and vice versa. You know, a flaw that a mare may have, you know, a lot of times it's about balancing temperament. You know, sometimes you have a mare that, you know, is kind of an ill-tempered mare, hard to deal with, and you want to balance her with a, you know, with an even-keeled, even-tempered stallion, and vice versa. So, you know, to me it's all about breeding balance. Now, when it comes to show horse stuff, I probably got 20 years of data on the different trends on, you know, what has crossed well with what to produce, you know, the best horses in the ring, and we've got a pretty good track record at that. But you know, all of them are different. But we, you know, we take each mare owner and each mare on an individual basis, and I try to give them what I consider my best choice for their mare. You know, sometimes
okay.
My best choice may not be under my roof. You know, sometimes the absolute best choice for the mare, percentage wise, may be a stallion at another farm. And, you know, I'm free to share that with them. I'd like to keep their business, but I'll say, you know, out on parole is probably your best choice for this mare. I'd love to say you, you know, a black gin, but really your best choice out on parole. And really, customers appreciate that, and that's why they come back and do business with us.
Okay, well, and I would appreciate that as well. Krista, how much does the broodmare contribute to the foal?
Oh, you know, people argue that, but, some people say more than 50%, and I'd have to agree with that. It is so important, the mare, and the quality of the mare, and I tell you, the most heritable personality is probably the most heritable trait, and that's one thing that David was saying. If you do have a very high-strung mare, and you think you're going to go, you know, ride this as a pleasure horse, you must be very careful with which mare you have, because, you know, conformation is heritable. Disposition is, like I say, probably most heritable.
We always blame bad children on bad mamas. That's what
we're doing. So, we have only good studs here, of course.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has to be the mother.
Yeah.
But obviously people I think the quality of mare these days is extremely high. I have been impressed by the mares that people are breeding. We might be breeding a few less in the breed, but we are breeding a very high quality right now.
Well, that's good. And David, I'm sure that you have never seen in your years a person bring an inferior mare and want to breed to a top stallion and expect him to produce all of it.
Never. I've never had that happen, Gary.
Oh, goodness. Well, there's some things that we want to talk about in just a minute. We want to open up our phone lines to any of our listeners out there that would like to call in and would have questions for David or for Krista. And the phone number that you can call is 213-943-3396, 213-943-3396. And I'm sure there's some folks that might have some questions that they would like to ask David or Krista. We're going to take a quick break. And we'll come back in just a minute to talk more with David Williams and Dr. Krista Gullum. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Drifting again like an old tumbleweed, riding the wind with the dandelion seed. Someday I'll land, but I don't know when. Till then I'm drifting again. She cut me loose and told me don't come back. Now I'm like a hobo by the railroad track. Drifting again like an old tumbleweed, riding the wind. Dandelion seeds. Someday I'll land, but I don't know when. Till then I'm drifting again.
Drifting now, Joe. North, south, east, or west, it don't matter much to me.
I just couldn't grow them through these cowboy boots. Drifting again like an old tumbleweed, riding the wind with the dandelion seeds. Someday I'll land, but I don't know when. Till then I'm drifting again. guess I'm drifting. Till then I'm drifting again. Let's do some drifting. Here we go. Got the wind in my back. Yes, sir.
That's Drifting Again with our good friend and New Mexico cowboy R.W. Hampton. And R.W. will be in concert in Colorado Springs as part of the National Trail Ride to benefit the Fiona Rose Murphy Foundation on June the 7th. So just a little plug for R.W. And we appreciate everybody's help in helping us raise money for this foundation to help the kids that are dealing with brittle bone disease. But we're talking with David Williams and Dr. Krista Gellum. And, you know, the cost of breeding has gone up just a little bit since I started breeding horses back in 1957. And, Krista, let me ask a question. When is the best time, what age is the best to start breeding a mare, and when is too old to breed?
You know, again, it varies, but I always say a three-year-old is my preference. Not that if you get, you know, a lot of breeds don't start that young, but I have bred two-year-olds for people, and by the time they foal, they are three, but they are still growing. So my preference would be a three-year-old to wait till they're that age anyway. Okay, now if you wait till a mare is around, I always say around eight, you start to get into some trouble in some mares. And Mother Nature was set up, unfortunately, to breed at a young age. And I always say it's sort of like the uterus actually gets some disuse atrophy is how I always explain it. But the sometimes an eight-year-old mare that has not been bred, it's been used to a show, or they just fit their pet, and you start breeding it, A, will produce a very, very small foal if you're not careful. So, you know, there are some disadvantages of waiting. So, like I say, start around 3-4 years old, you know, and if you start too young, I do think it takes off the end of that mare's career. I do, the oldest mare I've seen that had a foal was 28, but that is so much the exception. Actually, there were two in my, that I can remember that were 28 years old, and the owner just couldn't, they just didn't want to stop. And the mare would continue to produce, if she did produce the foal, both of those mares did. Now, normally you start to see problems start occurring around 16. You'll start to get uterine cysts at a higher number. You start to have, you know, where their uterus just doesn't contract as well after they foal. You just start to have some problems generally around 16. By the time they're 20, you have certain mares that conceive easily still, and then you've got some mares that are starting to get into real trouble where they're having trouble clearing the fluid from their uterus, many different things. But, you know, how old a mare is so, you know, I always say it's like a person. You know, 20 is old for some mares, and some mares look like they're 12. And a lot of it does with how those people have cared for those mares. If they've left those babies on till they're 8 months old, 10 months old, and not weaned foals, you know, so much has to do with the care of those mares, but, again, genetics of that mare.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, that's possible to know how old a mare is too old. Okay.
Right. Well, I've had some myself that have been, I know, 27. A couple of different
Absolutely.
Mares that come to mind that were 27 years old. One of them was a three-quarter sister mm-hmm. to Ebony Masterpiece, and we bought her at 9 in foal. And her last baby, she was 27 years old. You know, one of the, and this may be an old wives' tale, or there may be something to this, but at one time the thought was, if you breed your mare every year, you don't have a problem, but if you skip years, you could have a problem. Is there anything to that? Some people like to breed a year, skip a year, breed a year. Is there a best way to go? Or
It is not a wives' tale. As a matter of fact, some of the most difficult mares, and David might argue with me here, but, you know, people, when they leave mares open, if you go 1 year, you seem to do all right. I'm assuming, and people, that's where David was bringing up the culture. People assume, oh, my mare just sold. She doesn't have an infection. Well, unfortunately, it's probably one of the leading causes of getting an infection is not clearing up after foaling. So what they do, you know, we have people that have a fall, and then they leave the mare open till the next year, and unfortunately, she carried an infection. And that can be just devastating on a uterus. So, you know, and again, Mother Nature intended for that uterus to be busy. So if you leave a mare open, some of the worst ones I have are been open 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and they can be very, very difficult to get back in foal because, you know, the uterus has, again, it's just not been used, and there's, you know, glands in there that are not being used, and they when they're not staying active, they just become sort of shrink. So it is not a wives' tale by any means. It's just part of the process.
Well, I remember that one 27-year-old mare that we bought at 9 produced 14 foals for us.
Wow!
And so we did miss a year or two, but she was a pretty consistent producer. I think anybody would be happy with a mare that produced that many babies for them for that long.
Absolutely, but you know, we'll get the occasional mare that you get one or two babies, and that will be it. And then they start accumulating fluid, but a lot of these have had a show career and people have started late. And again, those are very difficult at times, but you know, everybody would love to have a mare like you're talking about.
Right. Now, talking about the mares that are in the show ring, today we can do embryo transfers, and people can continue to show. Does that happen very much today?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I discourage embryo transfer in some people because of the, you know, it is an added expense. And also, you know, it's not like we're taking and doing this all in a lab dish. We're actually flushing an 8-day-old, 7-day-old embryo out of the uterus. And, you know, it comes with, you know, it's problems. But when I say that, you won't always get one. Okay, it's not like a cow where you can super ovulate one and come up with 40 or 50 eggs. So, you know, it's just, it is a procedure. We have, Dr. Wilhelm does most of the embryo flushes out at Rising Star, and he's done it for years and does a fine job. We all line them up, you know, I line them up and he flushes. And, you know, the ones I encourage people to do embryo transfer aren't exactly the mare you're saying. It's the one that's in the show ring. They don't want to stop, and they want a baby, and it's a perfect scenario for embryo transfer. And, you know, and also a mare who is at the end of where she can, in other words, you have mares that abort 4, 5, 6, 7 months, you know, that thing every year. Those are another obvious, because they're getting in foal. The uterus is healthy enough for an embryo to be down there at 6, 7 days, but, you know, they're not able to carry their own foal. Those are another real good embryo transfer case.
Okay. Well, and again, talking about the fact that raising horses is more expensive than it was 50 years ago, 10 years ago. It's more important, I would think, to make sure that you are maintaining in your herd the best quality mares that you can have and that they're receiving the best care that they can possibly receive, both prior to breeding and after that. But let's talk a little bit about the folks that have had these babies. And they're going to market their colts.
Okay.
What's the best way to take care of these colts? When should they be? What kind of feeding regimen should they be on? When's the best time to wean a colt? And David, we want to talk a little bit about marketing in just a little bit, because I've told you before, I think you're one of the sharpest marketers in the business. But Krista, talk to us a little bit about the foal care and weaning process.
Absolutely. Again, there's not one simple solution for any. I say you're just going to have to watch your mare. If you have a, like you're talking, that 27-year-old mare or a mare that's 20 years old and a hard keeper, you're not going to want to leave a foal on that mare as long as you will, you know, a young, healthy mare. I generally, you know, say anytime after, you know, I try to get people to wait till about 4 months or later, and often leave somewhere around 5 or 6, depending on how the baby's growing or how the foal's growing. But I always say the perfect time to wean is when that foal is eating grain well. Because I've had people have them out in the pasture that were 7 months old, and they had them running around after their mother, and they throw them into a stall and say, hey, we're, this is a perfect day to wean. Well, they've never seen grain in their life, and they do very, very, very poorly. So,
right.
You know, weaning, it has to do with the care again. I personally, you know, there's many feeds out there. You know, people a lot of times use too much protein in these foals. Usually around 11 or 12% is more than sufficient. And if they're eating with their mothers at 11 or 12% protein grain, it's great, but there's a lot of mothers that do not share well. So, you know, you've got to take a lot into consideration when you go to wean that, you know, I always encourage people to put a separate bucket in for the baby. You know, even I start babies creek feeding when they're a couple weeks old. I say put a bucket on the ground beneath the mare and let them play in it. Then if the worst scenario happens and something happens to your mare, you know, they're eating, okay? And a lot of babies will start playing in that feed very, very early if they're given the opportunity. And, you know, they stay healthier and, you know, keep their weight well. But, again, I wean somewhere, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 months is, to me, a good time, depending on the foal.
Okay. And those foals that are weaned at 4 months, if they're eating well, will do as well as a foal that's weaned at 6 months.
Yes, they generally will. You know, now, if you had a slow start in a foal, you know that's probably not the case. But again, you have to evaluate each horse on an individual basis. And and I have people that have colts spread out and they wean them all at the same time. Some will be 4 months, some will be 6. I always say, obviously, group the little ones together. You know, just, you know, use a lot of common sense is the main thing. And, you know, shots now, they don't – generally, we wait a little longer to give shots than we used to. At one time, they recommended, like, 3 and 4 months for shots. That is not the case anymore. If you've vaccinated your mare and you've had your two-for-one special that has gone through in the colostrum to your foal, they're finding that the antibodies actually are block the vaccine that you use if you use it too early.
Okay.
So,
all right.
What they recommend now is more waiting till the foals are about 6 or 7 months old before you give them their original and their boosters on the vaccinations. And I really, really tell people don't forget to do that, because tetanus is the dumbest disease known to man. And I do still occasionally, it is. And I still see it's a very inexpensive, very good vaccine. And when I see it, it's devastating. And it's tetanus is just too simple. Even if you don't give anything else, at least give that baby an original booster on tetanus. Okay?
Okay. All right. Now, I'm approaching foaling time. The way I used to do it was put my broodmares on what I called a dry lot, where I was giving them a quality hay and some good feed before they birthed. She's had the baby now, and I'm feeding her. In a day or two, my colt has scoured.
Okay.
What have I done?
You know, a day or two old, there it can either be a sick diarrhea or non-sick diarrhea. Is what I always tell people when they call me up and say, hey, do I need to come out? And I go, well, you know, it depends on the quality of the diarrhea and how that baby's acting. You really haven't done anything. Babies, and they really still don't know why foals get diarrhea, particularly around foal heat. There's a lot of argument. It's just a change in flora of the bowel at that time. Some people argue it's parasites. I do think it's a change in the bacteria probably because, you know, you consistently see it and you consistently see babies picking up their mother's, you know, poop, trying to feed their bowel. But if I have a baby with a little loose stool and it looks like, you know, like bird poop, you know,
right.
I don't get too excited if they're still going up to their mom and nursing and you take their temperature and it's normal. You know, you can give them a probiotic, and usually they'll work their way through. But when you have a baby that is uninterested or acts sleepier than normal or won't nurse from its mom, hey, then you need to call a veterinarian because or if you've got a temperature and anything over about 102 is the temperature in a baby, they run a little higher.
Okay.
But that said, then you need somebody to come help. And we have so many different products on the market now to use with a baby with loose stool. But, you know, I usually don't get too excited unless it's a sick diarrhea.
Okay. How should I be feeding my mare after she's had the baby?
Now, you know, I consistently use anywhere around 11 or 12% on a grain ration. And assuming your mare is not too obese, then I used, you know, different products that do not require, and I don't want to promote one product over another, but they make different supplements that have protein and vitamins, but most of mares I'll have on about 6 pounds twice a day before they fall of a grain ration, and about 12%, and I continue it the same after they fall.
Okay.
Some mares are going to require more energy, and rather than up in the grain ration, the current thought is more to go with fat products. I use a lot of fat. You know, rice bran is what a lot of people have heard of. You know, again, I hate to toot one person's product over another because there's just so many different fat. But fat will add calories without getting the mare into more problem with just giving them such a high-carb diet. So, you know, you can go up to 8 pounds twice a day easily in a mare with a foal by their side if they start to lose weight. But, you know, again, that would depend on the mare. And it also, I would say, it depends on what the quality of your feed is. When I say that, I mean your hay. It's just so important to keep hay in front of a mare. People want to give a flake or two, but, you know, most of the mares that I see that lose weight is because they haven't had access to enough roughage.
Okay.
And let's say, and alfalfa is a good, it's a legume. Is what it is. It's not really a grass hay, and it's fine to use, but you know, you've got to be very careful because you can't give necessarily the quantity.
Right, right. Well, David, let me ask this question of you, and when you wean your colts, do you wean by the signs or what?
I do, Gary. I've always weaned by the signs, unless it was inconvenient that day to do it. But we try to wean by the signs because, you know, if we don't and something goes wrong, somebody will say, well, why didn't you wean by the signs? So we just try to get that covered from the get-go.
Okay. All right. So let's talk just a little bit about, you know, I've weaned my colt now, and I have plans on marketing this colt. What kind of attention does this colt get early on, and what happens to it if I'm getting ready to plan on a yearling sale for the colt?
Well, one thing I want to emphasize or reemphasize, like what Crystal was touching on, you know, feeding in a warming schedule is probably your most important thing for your colt.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people meet colts that are, you know, pedigree-wise, they're like, you know, super horses. And then they bring the individual in here, and I go, you know, when's the last time you wormed him? And they go, well, we wormed him back in the springtime, and here we are midsummer. And what I tell people, I said, you don't even have to break them. You don't have to touch them, do anything to them. If you'll bring them to me fat, I can make everything else happen. If you'll just bring them to me fat and slick, I mean, you don't even have to touch them. But, you know, the colts that we deal with, you know, people raise these colts, and, you know, they're their companions, and they go out there and they rub on them and love on them. Just keep in mind that the tricks that you like making your colt do or respond to you in a certain way is not going to be the way that next person buys a colt likes that colt to respond. I have a lot of trainers that would rather buy that raw, untouched colt. And, you know, that's kind of what we specialize out here. A lot of people like with them when they're baby colts, and when they get too big to play with, I tell them, I say, put them out of the field, let them be a horse. Just make sure you feed them, care for them. If you want to show them as yearlings, you know, do that as much as you want to, but always let them be outside and be a horse. We have people send colts in here that are what I call at different degrees of tameness. Most of the time it's to the far extreme. We've got some that, I tell you what, and I guess it's just I'm a glutton for punishment, but when they come off that trailer breathing fire, I'm thrilled. when they come in here and they act like they're going to eat us up, I'm thrilled because that's the colt I love. Because that's the colt that will react to you. That's the colt that will listen. That's the colt that's really not used to humans, but, you know, he's aware of you, and every move you make, you know, he's aware of it. So, you know, we just try to say don't handle them too much at home. Handle them enough that you feel comfortable with. You know, worm them, give them great quality hay, great quality feed, send them to me fat, we'll do everything else.
Okay. Well, now I know with my babies, I always tried to halter break them as early as I could, just easier for me to handle. But after that, they pretty much were out with their mamas. You know, occasionally we'd get up, get them up, and lead them a little bit. But as far as doing anything else with them, that was about it. So I would assume that's what you're talking about as far as the kind of colts that you'd like to have come in.
Absolutely. You'd like them to be able to handle some. And doing it when they're a baby on their mama is the best time, you know, because that baby will remember being led. I mean, if you lead him for 2 or 3 weeks when he's a baby colt and then just leave him alone, he'll always remember being led. So, you know, it sticks with him.
Okay. Now, you have done something this past year that's a little bit different as far as marketing colts. Now, and again, let's point out that there's a difference. If you're raising a colt for yourself, you may want to spend more time with that colt all the way from birth up. But if you're actually raising a colt to sell as a yearling, kind of pay attention to what David's been saying here. But you did something different this last year. Most people are accustomed to going to yearling sales and yearling production sales, and there are not as many of those as there were as I was growing up and in the last several years. Talk to us a little bit about what you did there at Rising Star.
Well, let me give you a little background, Gary, because my history is selling yearlings. I mean, We sold the highest selling yearling ever at public auction. I think I sold the lowest selling yearling ever at public auction. You know, in every price range in between. The yearling auctions has got to a point where the public is more educated. They're not going to come in there and make a 5, 10, 15-minute decision on a horse. You know, their money's more valuable to them nowadays. They're going to do their research when they come in. They're going to know almost what they want before they come to a sale. And if they see something in the catalog that kind of matches what they want, they will come look at that colt. The days of, you know, what I call people with a lot of disposable income come in there and just invest in a lot of colts, you know, those days are long gone. Those people are trying to make every dollar count. So they expect more. And the buying public's more educated, and they'll come in and they're looking for a particular thing. Well, I have a wife and I have a daughter, and I've listened to them most of my life, and it's done me well to do that. We are in, my daughter has told me we're in an eBay society, and my wife and daughter likes that show Say Yes to the Dress. And whenever that's on in like a marathon fashion, I have to sit there and watch these people sell these dresses to everybody. I said, that's exactly what I need to do, and that's exactly how we did it last year. Last year we had over 100 yearlings here. The public will come in here, and I'll ask them, I said, what exactly are you looking for? Just no different to them going into that line of dress store saying, you know, I want this style, this fashion, this style. And what we do, we kind of know what coats will match that criteria, and we start getting them out. We show our coats at liberty. Nobody's leading them. Nobody's altering their gait. And granted, our walking horse breed is a gated breed. We are known for our gait. And we have a natural gait. These horses naturally gait. So by showing them at liberty in a show pen that we have here going back and forth, that coat will show you its natural gait, and in your mind you know what training or what trainer or how that horse will develop. You'll get an idea. So, you know, along that same mentality of Say Yes to the Dress, they'll come in here and we'll show them a colt. They go, I don't like that one. I can know in about two passes whether they like the colt or not. You know, and I'll say, go get another dress. Go get another colt. We'll bring another one in. Then we'll bring another one in. And the way we do it, I can show you about 20 colts before you can blink an eye. And somewhere in that 20, you'll find something you like. Now, applying that eBay mentality on all our colts here, you'll see the pedigree and all the pertinent information on the door. We're lucky we get a lot of the famous colts. We get all the brothers and sisters mainly to, you know, horses that are showing the ring, horses that people know, or the daughters or the sons of the horses people know. We have all that information on the door. We have a buy-it-now price on every colt. That way, you know, I call that the high retail price. If somebody wants to come in here and not compete with somebody else getting the colt they want, then go ahead and pay that buy-it-now price right now. We'll have a minimum bid. And what that does for the buyer comes in here, he says, well, there's the high price, there's a low price. Somewhere in between those two prices, I'm going to get to buy that colt. So that buyer kind of knows what range that colt's going to fall in, and it'll either, you know, turn them away or they'll have more interest in the colt. What it'll also do is when I'm showing that colt in the pen, and granted, the owners and I myself feel like this is a $5,000 or $6,000 yearling. Somebody says, you know, I'm going to give you $2,500 for that colt. Well, unlike the traditional auction where, you know, not many people are there to bid, and they bid $2,500, people feel, well, that's a $2,500 colt. Well, that's not the case. That
right,
colt
right.
to me is still a $5,000 colt. And I say, if you want to see a $2,500 colt, let me go get one and I'll show you the difference. Mm-hmm. Well, I usually get that $2,500 colt. They see the difference and they go, you know, I really would like that $5,000 colt. I say, well, he costs $5,000. This is $2,500. You know, you make your decision. Do you want more colt or do you want to spend less money? And,
right.
You know, that's what we run into. And we've been able to service and help our clients and our customers sell colts at a higher rate. I mean, our top 40 last year, you know, granted this is not as big in numbers as we've done in the past, but our top 40, you know, averaged $4,000 a head. You know, some of the traditional auctions, their high-selling colt was, you know, just a little over five. Our top 20, you know, averaged way over that. So basically, at any one time, we may not have had at the most 20 people in our building at any one time. But those people there were there to, with a purpose, to buy a colt and had a particular colt he was looking for, and we were going to do our best to find them that colt.
Well, that's great, and it was, you know, when I saw this, when I saw you doing this past fall, I thought, well, that's just a great way to market the colts. It gives people an opportunity to look, to evaluate, to decide what they're looking for, and know what they're going to need to spend. To buy the kind of coat that they're looking for. So great marketing program. And by the way, this thing of letting the colts out in the pen so they can move naturally,
mm-hmm.
I think is great, because I have been able to tell myself about my colts out in the pasture, just moving and watching them. a lot more than I could about a cult that's being led, because
absolutely,
yeah, it really makes a big difference. So I think that was a great way to do that.
It appeals to people of all genres too. I mean, it's not strictly, you know, a performance, you know, future of a performance horse cult. You know, the flat shot people that are the flat shot enthusiasts, they come in there, they like those colts. And even the people that are looking for field trial horses, we sold a lot of those last year. They have a particular style of colt they're looking for, a bigger bone, you know, kind of a slower going type colt. You know, people know what they're looking for, and they come in there, and, you know, we just try to help them find it.
Yeah, well, I think that is great. So we'll look forward to seeing you repeat that this fall. With your yearling sale as well. Let's talk just a minute, David, about where you see the market going, because, you know, I do a lot of reading about different breeds of horses, as well as the walking horses. A recent article I read that was done by the American Saddlebred was talking about the decrease in number of foals that were going to be able to be put under saddle. To be able to replace the horses, and they were talking specifically about the show ring. Where do you see that as far as the Tennessee walking horse and what you're looking for in the future, this year, maybe 2 years from now?
You know, our breed, you know, back during the early, you know, end of the 90s, the 2000s, early 2000s, you know, all the way up to, you know, 4 or 5, we overgrew our market.
Mm-hmm.
We were producing, you know, around 15,000 colts, which is a huge glut of colts to throw in on the market. You know, granted, we were selling a lot of those colts high. And that just generated more people wanting to raise those colts. Now, whether it was published or not, those people really weren't selling those colts that high, you know, all the way across the board. I mean, we had a high end that was doing well. But, you know, in the advent of, you know, the anti-horse slaughter legislation, which everybody has their opinion on it, but the unwanted horses, that's where they usually went. You know, it's nothing, you know, nice to talk about, but, you know, the facts of the matter, you know, people dealt with horses like they deal with any other agriculture. Well, now society's changed. You know, we've gone from, you know, an agriculture to society that, you know, animals, you know, a lot of the public out there feel like they're companion animals. So, you know, they've got horse slaughter legislation, you know, past where, you know, there's no more, you know, disposing of those unwanted horses here in the United States. That has changed the market more drastic than anything. It caused the bottom to fall out of the market. We've gone through some, you know, some bad years, and we're recovering. But what I think we've done is basically, you know, a healthy balancing of our production versus our demand.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're still producing more colts than the saddlebred people. And I say our production will, you know, increase back up to what I call, you know, probably a 7,000, 8,000, maybe 9,000, you know, colt year production each year. And for the longest, the Breeder Association ran on about a 6,000 to 7,000 colt production, you know, all the way back in the 40s. It's all about finding that horse, finding a place in life. And I think we've made a great balancing recovery, and I just see everything, you know, working for the better right now. Now, we've got a product that's one of the best horse products out there. We've got that smooth riding, docile, you know, willing horse. I've dealt with a lot of breeds. I've never dealt with a horse more forgiving of humans than this horse. They're willing to do whatever you want, whenever you want. They're the smoothest riding horse. They're easy to get along with. They're very trainable. You know, we just have one of the best products out there, and, you know, I just don't see anything but, you know, good things to come.
Okay. Well, I know that that the economy has changed things, the demographics as far as where people are, the amount of horse property that's available to raise horses and keep horses is constantly changing. And there's several things. This may be a topic for another show that we want to get into sometime about the demographics and where the market is going and for horses in general. But thanks for sharing your insights and your thoughts on that. And I know for a minute there we put your hat on as the TWEBA Vice President for the Breeders Division. So we've been talking more about breeding farms and breeding. But we shifted gears for just a minute there. Krista, let me ask you if you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience about anything that's key to get ready for this breeding season.
Well, you know, you did pass by one thing that I guess I sort of, it was the worming. I guess we didn't touch on that enough for my liking. You know, we get so many colics that I think are unnecessary when we have these mares come in. It's not so much we're careful about how we change the feed when they come, you know, and how we feed them. But on the other hand, people really need to keep up. You know, it has gone more toward veterinarians taking fecals to see if horses are shedding parasites or not. That actually what the new research they're trying to tell everybody is 80% of the parasites are shed by 20% of the horses, so to speak.
Ooh, wow.
So, you know, trying to identify who the problem horses are. And I have to say I went out in my own pasture and took a fecal on everybody, and I have a couple of clients with 20 or some horses, and they wanted to do it that way. And it did statistically work out to about 20% that were really shedding parasites. And these are the ones that are also, you have quite a few recurrent colicers, and they come into the breeding farms, and we want healthy horses to work on. But, you know, that also foals, that is something I couldn't stress more, is that if you're going to, babies should be, you should worm a foal starting at 2 months.
Okay.
The cycle of a parasite is such that if you start before that, you're pretty much worming air. But, you know, they're not mature enough. The parasites, about 60 days, though, you should worm your foal. And personally, I worm them, you know, almost every month till they're about 6 months old, and I get on a two-month worming program. And that's what David was saying about his yearlings. The parasite problems are more in foals and yearlings. Their immune system does help them later in life. But, you know, the main thing is we need a healthy mare having a healthy baby. But it's most important to have that healthy mare first, because the foal is not going to do well. I always say they just go hand in hand. When I start having troubles with the mare when she foals, I'm going to have a little trouble with the baby. You know, they just go together. And you just, if you have that healthy mare that's going to foal, you've kept them on a good plane of nutrition, gotten rid of the fescue from their diet for at least 60 days, you've got her wormed, you know, our job's going to be a whole lot easier and much more apt to get one in foal for you.
Okay. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us on the show today. And if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
We have a clinic. It's Rolling Hills Equine Clinic. It's in Shelbyville. And, of course, you can find me out at Rising Star several days a week. And I appreciate you letting me have this time, and thanks for putting on the program.
Well, just so glad that you could join us, and I hope this wasn't too bad for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had something real quick before I give you my closing thoughts. Me and Chris, during your little break there,
yeah,
we were telling a few little stories. Now, there's some stories that are very entertaining that I don't think we can tell on the air around here.
Well, we may have to share those in person or over the phone or something, but yeah, I'd love to hear some of those sometime. Well, David, share some final thoughts with us
Well, one thing I want to touch on before I get into that, because you touched on the Fianna Rose Foundation, and I know you're doing like a some auctions of some stunt fees. I just wanted to go ahead and announce that we're donating the Tweeba overall Sire of the Year stallion feed to you, which is lined with cash.
Oh.
I'm working on a couple other items, so I want you to go ahead and have lined with cash do that, and hopefully we raise a lot of money for this foundation. I know it's a project of yours that you hold dear to your heart, and you've caused all the rest of us to hold dear to our hearts, too, and we're real excited about the trail rides coming up this summer.
Well, David, I just want to say thank you, and I so appreciate that, and appreciate the support that you're giving us. It's very important. I think we're making a difference for young people's lives by putting on this program, and it's just a positive thing all the way around. So you do not know how much I appreciate the Lined with Cash stud fee. And
we're excited about all your work that you do toward this.
Well, thanks so much. I will mention at this point that the online auction is on Facebook. It starts tonight at 8:00. The first stud fee that we're offering is the 2003 World Grand Champion, the whole nine yards, and we appreciate the nine group and Spencer and Carrie Benedict for offering that one. But that starts at 8:00 tonight on Facebook, and you can go to the Fianna Rose Murphy Foundation Trail Ride Facebook page to make your bids and to keep up with what's going on there. So, but David, thanks again so much for that line with cash. I'm looking out in the pasture from my studio at my Lined with Cash colt, and he's an awesome.
I hope he's good.
But he's terrific. As a matter of fact, Paige Edwards told me the other day that he's a full brother to a past world grand champion. So pretty nice colt. But anyway.
Good.
Thank you so much for that, and go ahead and share some final thoughts with our listeners.
Well, like you said, raising horses, and dealing with horses, you have the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. I mean, it's a journey. Anybody out there that runs across something that they feel like, I don't know what to do. I've got questions I can't get answered. They can always feel free to call me here at Rising Star. If we don't have the answers, we'll know the people who will. Because we want everybody's experience in raising that colt to, be a joyful experience. It doesn't always work out that way, but I tell you what, when it does, it's something memorable. We're always here. My phone's always on. Our door's always open. You come to Rising Star, you can see us anytime. The studs would love to see visitors every day. And, Gary, I appreciate this opportunity to being able to share some of our stories and sharing some information with your listeners.
Well, I appreciate you so much and appreciate you taking the time to join us, and as well as Krista. Let me ask this real quick. Krista, do you have Rolling Hills, do you have a website?
No, I don't. Unfortunately, I'm sort of stretched for time almost every day of the week, and but I'm very good about trying to talk to anyone that will call, okay? And
right.
Like I say, I appreciate you letting me share, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, call Rising Star. We'll get you in touch with you.
Yeah, Rising
okay.
Star.
All right, we'll do that. And Rising Star has a Facebook page, so we'd encourage people to visit and like their page on Facebook, Rising Star Ranch, and then what's your website, David?
Yeah, my website also is www.attherisingstar.com, attherisingstar.com.
All right, attherisingstar.com. And so we're just again, tickled to have had both of you on the show. Some great, great information that you've shared with us today, and again, I just want to thank you so much. And, David, I'll give you a call just a little bit later, and we'll chat some. But, again, thanks to Krista Gillum and to David Williams for joining us today on Equestrian Legacy Radio. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Gary.
All right. Thanks. All right, well, just a fun show we've had talking with Joni Harms and listening to her great music. Again, we appreciate Dr. Krista Gillum joining us and David Williams for joining us, and again, appreciate that fabulous donation of the line with Cash Studfee. He was the Sire of the Year this past year with the Walking Horse Breeders Association. A couple of things that we want to mention to you, and that is the National Trail Ride for the Fiona Rose Murphy Foundation, and that is June 5th through the 7th. It's being held in 5 states across the United States the first week of June. This is the first ride. We've got great vendors that will be at each location. We have clinics that are being put on. We have tremendous concerts that will be held, and we encourage people to check TWHBEA.com for more information, or you can go to our website, EquestrianLegacy.net, for information on the trail ride. It has the exact locations, some beautiful trails, a great 3 days to support a very, very worthy cause. And again, visit EquestrianLegacy.net or TWHBEA.com for more information on the Fiona Rose Murphy Foundation National Trail Ride. Also, the National Trainers Horse Show begins this evening in Shelbyville, Tennessee at the CalSonic Arena, and that runs through Saturday evening. And then a big event that a lot of people will want to attend is the Road to the Horse in Lexington, Kentucky at the Kentucky Horse Park, and that's taking place this weekend as well. So we thank you for listening and joining us today on Equestrian Legacy Radio. We have a fun show lined up next Thursday. We come to you each week at noon Central Standard Time on Equestrian Legacy Radio. And we remind you, as always, if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride. Thanks for listening.
Learn to let go.